Hey everybody, welcome to Sweater Weather, a podcast about Canadian arts and culture. I am Aaron Giovannone, a writer in Calgary, Alberta.
And I'm Naomi Lewis, a novelist and nonfiction writer in Calgary, Alberta.
Naomi, how are you feeling about our topic today? Kids in the Hall.
How am I feeling? A little confused, but I'm ready. I'm ready to go.
It is a confusing show. Mm-hmm. It's kind of all over the place.
Yeah, it leaves you feeling like you just got hit on the head with something. You're not sure what, but you're laughing.
So before we get started, I just want to remind everybody that patrons of the show over on patreon.com/Canadian Sweater get access to full episodes of the show. That's about twice the content that's available on the free feed. So if you're interested in getting the full episode about Kids in the Hall and all other episodes of Sweater Weather that come out, just head on over to patreon.com/Canadian Sweater and sign up. You'll see there's different tiers, different benefits, all kinds of other things available over there. So, the Kids in the Hall. What are your memories of Kids in the Hall?
From when it was on originally, yeah. I remember very vaguely seeing little clips of it and feeling kind of disturbed in an unpleasant way that made me not want to watch it anymore. And I always just thought I didn't like the show, basically. And I remember a lot of... When did it start? What year was it?
1988.
Okay, so yeah, I guess in high school. I started high school in 1990. Mm-hmm. So probably even before... So grade 7, 8, and then into high school, there were kids my age who watched the show, like boys, really, especially, and who would quote bits of it, like kind of in the same way that they would quote Monty Python, just like the same lines over and over in like a kind of like distressing, repetitive way that seemed more like obsessive than entertaining.
What were the quotable lines for teenage boys in the 1990s?
I'm crushing your head,
of
they
course,
would say. And they would
one.
Go like this. Crushing your head.
That's right.
And they would say it in a weird voice. I'm crashing our head.
Right, an Eastern European accent.
Yes.
Looking back at the show now, Mark McKinney is, yeah, his famous character. Mm-hmm. You realize, oh, that he's like imitating like a Czech person or something.
Yeah, or, no, I think he actually is Croatian. He says at one point.
Oh, he says he's Croatian.
Yeah, he does say he's Croatian.
Right, so that's funny. Yeah.
Yeah, and at one point he says he has like, he's angry because he thinks someone in his taxi. Or is that a different guy?
Yeah, he does another Eastern European character.
That guy's Croatian because he doesn't like Serbs, he says.
Oh, okay, that comes up in one
of
the episodes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And
right.
He says something about in the original Croatian, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
But, yeah, so the crushing your head. And then the other one was the chicken lady where people would just go like, buck, 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 I'm the chicken lady. And it was just confusing to me.
I mean, these are great. These are great sketches. Rewatching the show, I have to say, I think I appreciate it more as an adult mm-hmm. with just like a firmer sense of the world
yes.
that the show is actually spoofing and referring to. So,
yes.
Yeah, I think I didn't, I'm similar to you. I mean, Kids in the Hall was on TV so much. It was always on CBC. I grew up in the country where we had like 8 television stations on antenna.
Mm-hmm.
So CBC was one of the mainstays. It was always on. And Kids in the Hall seemed to be constantly playing, like late at night. I think it broadcast late at night.
Okay.
Relatively late at night in Canada mm-hmm. too, so.
Yeah, I don't think I ever went out, like tried to watch it. I feel like it might have been on at other people's houses or,
yeah,
I just was convinced that I hated it, so.
I likewise did not seek it out.
Yeah, and were you one of the boys that would go crushing your head and chicken lady?
Not too much.
Okay,
no,
not too
so.
Much.
Not too much, I don't think I did.
Okay.
Yeah. If I did, it was just to fit in. Not because I really wanted to.
But isn't that why we did everything we did?
Yeah, so what's spurring our topic today is that Kids in Hall just recently released a new season of their show after many years
yes.
Of not releasing seasons. So we're going to talk about a little bit the history of Kids in the Hall.
Mm-hmm.
So let's get into it. So did you know that Kids in the Hall began in Calgary?
I actually did.
Oh, you didn't know.
Tell me more.
So I guess you could say the Kids in the Hall begins with Bruce McCullough and Mark McKinney in 1981 mm-hmm. when they meet at Loose Moose Improv Theater.
Oh, I've been there.
we've been there. We've seen shows. It's mm-hmm. a longstanding cultural institution in Canada. I have a few more things to say about Loose Moose a little bit later, but it is like kind of Calgary's second city. You know, mm-hmm. the way that second city is such a big thing in Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
And it's produced like a fair share of actors and comedians, like the FUBAR boys, David Lawrence and Paul Spence from the FUBAR series. Oh, yeah. They from there, and also Andrew Fung from Kim's Convenience.
Oh,
actually,
yeah.
The show we saw,
Andrew, that was him.
Andrew Fung was performing. I think that was before Kim's Convenience. Now, Bruce McCullough, he was actually from Edmonton. His father was a traveling salesman.
Okay.
His father drank a lot of rye and ginger.
Okay.
He was an alcoholic.
Oh, no.
But he had an artsy side, and this seemed to influence Bruce McCullough. Bruce McCullough really liked music. He was kind of a punk rocker. And his dad would blare music late at night when he was drunk. McCullough's mom worked at Woolco.
Oh.
Remember Woolco?
I do.
Yeah. Bought out by Walmart at some point in the 90s, I think. Now, Bruce McCullough was athletic, and he won like provincial like track and swimming titles in high school, and he lifted weights competitively, but he was bullied a lot for being effeminate.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. So he ended up going to Mount Royal College at the time, right. Now a university.
Yeah.
So he moved to Calgary. He was studying business. Wasn't going very well.
Business, that's funny, because later on they would mock businessmen mercilessly.
Endlessly.
But he wanted to be a businessman at one point, so that's very interesting.
So a lot of this information today is coming from a book about the kids in the hall. It's called This is a Book About the Kids in the Hall by John Seemley. And so I think Seemley mentions, he makes a little joke in the book about you could play a drinking game with kids in the hall that involves taking a drink every time you see a businessman on screen. You wouldn't last very long, I don't think. There's so many businessmen. Now, Mark McKinney, he was a little bit different. He was actually the son of diplomats.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So he lived all over the world?
He did. Mexico, France, Trinidad.
Oh, wow.
So he ended up going to university at Memorial University in St. John's, Newfoundland, but moved to Calgary to work in the oil patch.
Really?
Which seems like a kind of youthful rebellion of like an upper middle class kid, probably.
Hmm.
But he started doing theater at Loose Moose, and Bruce McCullough like saw a show there and wanted to start doing it too. And so they did. And they met at Loose Moose. Now, on the other side of Canada, Dave Foley and Kevin MacDonald. They were, from Toronto. Those two met at Second City. They formed an improv group that they called The Kids in the Hall.
Okay, and do you know why they called it that? Or it was just...
The name, yeah. Well, it's good that you asked that. It is in my notes. So I guess it's a producer, like, at some point, told the kids when they were performing about a story involving legendary comedian Jack Benny at the Jack Benny Show. Apparently, young writers who wanted to sell Jack jokes for the show would hang out in the hall outside of the theater waiting for Jack to come out.
Mm-hmm.
And so he referred to them as the kids in the hall.
Uh-huh.
So outsiders trying to get in, trying to break into the business.
Nice.
That's the origin of the name. Dave Foley was from Etobicoke. His mother was English, born in England. His father was a steam fitter and also a big drinker.
Which What's is a steam fitter?
A steam fitter is like a pipe fitter.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's like an industrial job.
Mm-hmm. A big drinker, okay.
And a big drinker. And you see a theme emerging.
Indeed.
Here. Foley dropped out of high school. He wasn't a good student. He did stand-up comedy for a year. And then he started taking improv classes. Kevin MacDonald, he's from Montreal originally. His family moved around like to Los Angeles, then back to Toronto. His father was a dental equipment salesman. And a severe alcoholic.
Oh, no.
Apparently pretty bad. In later years, MacDonald actually wrote a one-man play about his dad.
Oh, wow.
MacDonald studied acting briefly at Humber College. He got kicked out because he couldn't do drama. He couldn't do dramatic roles.
Okay.
So they kicked him out.
He could only be funny.
They called him a one-legged comedian.
Okay.
Or sorry, one-legged actor, because he could only do comedy.
Yeah, I can see
so
that.
So it made sense for him to go to him to do improv at the Second City. Right?
Yeah.
So that's the scene of the original four. We're going to get to Scott Thompson in a minute, the fifth member. So the Calgarians, McCullough and McKinney, they moved to Toronto along with other comedians from their group. started performing in Toronto with the kids in the hall. I should say the McCullough and McKinney's group, it was called The Audience. That's what they called it. Oh. Like a meta.
Yeah, yeah.
Like it's like you get up there and say, well, ladies and gentlemen, the audience.
Oh, yeah. It's a bit much, really.
Yeah. It's a little too much. It's a little too much.
Clever. A little too clever.
Well, yes, too clever by half. I think there are a lot of meta moments because it is the 90s. And so that kind of thing was like avant-garde and cool. And you see it a lot in Kids in the Hall, but sometimes it works really well, actually.
Yeah, it's not surprising that they kind of went too far at one point and then reeled it back.
Yeah, exactly.
Into like the artsy meta kind of like fourth wall being broken thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, in the late 80s, this is still novel, I think, in the mainstream.
Yeah, but also like they were young and they were, you know, they had that kind of like, wow, we're going to be really smart about this. And you know, everyone does at first.
Yeah. Well, they have, I mean, the Kids in the Hall, I mean, seeing them again now, you're like, wow, for a main, like a show that was on CBC and was on HBO, it was mainstream show. Mm-hmm. Like, it is very, like, artsy. It's, like, incredibly, it is incredibly, like, highfalutin, you might even say.
Yeah,
and you're like,
way,
and you're kind of surprised that could happen, but I think it was a little bit different in the 90s.
Well, rewatching it recently, I realized that, but I think like when I first, my impression of it in the 90s was just that it was like pure slapstick, gross out humor, right?
Right.
And I think that was just because, again, because it was filtered through other kids my age who were quoting their favorite parts, and the only part that they could really grasp, or like that we could really grasp with our puny brains, was like the most silly parts.
Yeah. I mean, it did appeal at that on that level.
It did. Yeah, it had that level.
I think watching it now, I do appreciate it on other levels too. And I think at the time, more mature audiences did appreciate
it. Yeah, and that must have been why it was so popular. I mean, it couldn't like stand on silly grossness alone.
Yeah, well, we'll see when we get to the Kids in the Hall, like when they start performing together.
Mm-hmm.
Their origins are extremely artsy and extremely highbrow.
We're getting there. That's
so
interesting.
So just to finish up here with the five members. So Scott Thompson, he joined the group a little bit later. The Kids in the Hall had already started performing together.
Oh.
He was from North Bay. He moved to Brampton with his family when he was a kid. He was gregarious, well-liked. I mean, he's such a big personality on screen. That's not surprising. His dad did not like that he was gay or suspected him of being gay or whatever. So something weird about Scott Thompson, at his high school in Brampton, there was a school shooting in 1975.
Oh, my goodness.
When a student gunman wounded 13 and killed two people and himself. And Scott Thompson was there.
Oh, my goodness.
It was like his teacher was murdered.
Anyway, wow.
Yeah.
So his dad didn't like him being gay, to get back to that. So it sounds like, I mean, all of these kids in the hall, like they didn't have the best dads. Is it fair to say?
It's fair to say.
Yeah.
And you can tell with all the dad characters.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of bad dads. There's a lot of grumpy old men.
Yes.
A lot of drinkers.
A lot of drinkers.
Yeah.
Yes. A lot of grumpy dads. That's a major theme.
It really is.
Yeah. Huh. And what about their moms? They were like...
Well, I mean, I don't know. I didn't come across anything about Scott Thompson's mom, but to me, I'm assuming he had a nice mom. Why? Only because he plays mother characters so well.
Yeah, he does.
I mean, I love Scott Thompson's mother characters. They're kind of a traditional housewife.
Very loving,
very like caring up for the kids, especially worried about them. But then there's always this other level of like basically tragedy.
Yeah.
Like there's this tragic element to these women who are trapped.
With
awful husbands stuck in their house, in their role. And to me, there's like incredible pathos with Scott Thompson's mother character. So I'm assuming that maybe he had a mother that he really loved.
Maybe.
Or was very caring and he felt sorry for at some level too. I'm not really sure. That's my conjecture. Because I didn't read anything more about Scott Thompson's mom. Mm-hmm. Now, he went to York University. He told his family that he was studying journalism. But he was actually studying theater. He was part of a comedy troupe called The Love Cats.
Oh, wow. That's so cute.
So he met, so as I said, he saw the kids performing, mm-hmm. and he he threw donuts at them on stage. I guess they were having a bad show. Really? But that was one of the ways he got noticed by them. He really did want to join the club in the group. And he
That's
did.
That's one way to do it.
And he did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the kids, they performed at the Rivoli Theater.
Rivoli.
On Queen Street West, downtown Toronto. This was like a restaurant in the front and a music venue in the back. And it was the hub of like the early 80s punk scene.
It was still there when I lived in Toronto.
It was probably still pretty hip. When was this? The early 2000s? It's still
there
now. You
know, I went to a show there for New Year's Eve 2003.
Okay.
And
I'm sure it was hip. I mean, it's still hip now.
And you know who was playing?
No way. Who?
The Sadies.
Oh, okay.
The Sadies, Dallas Good, member of the Sadies,
mm-hmm.
plays the theme song of the new season of Kids in the Hall.
Right, but that's before he passed away.
Yes.
Because he died now.
Yeah, recently.
Right.
Very recently.
Right, so the theme song was originally performed by Shadowy Men from a Shadowy Planet. Is that the name of the band?
Shadowy Men on a Shadowy
is
Planet,
that what it
I
is?
Think.
Okay.
Yeah.
The Rivoli, like in the 80s, was like super hip, super alternative. Like what happened in Toronto is like in the 60s, like the first bohemia alternative neighborhood was Yorkville.
Oh, okay.
That's where all the hippies and writers and musicians lived. Like Gordon Lightfoot lived there, Margaret Atwood lived there. Like that was bohemia,
mm-hmm.
which is hilarious to think about because Yorkville is like the most ridiculously. It's like comically gentrified. It's so shishi poo poo.
I mean, it's like aristocratic.
It's aristocratic yeah. now. Like that's where diplomats live or whatever.
Oh yeah, definitely.
So it's amazing. Anyway, that scene was like gentrifying, and so the art scene moved to Queen West because there was kind of it was a post industrial place.
Mm-hmm.
Rents were cheap, and so it became the center of a vibrant alternative art scene. And so, I have a quote here from a 1984 Globe and Mail article writing about the Rivoli. He says that Liam Lacey wrote, quote, "The spirit of self-conscious bohemia haunts the back room of the Rivoli restaurant on Queen West. Abstract geometric art decorates the right-hand wall, mirrors on the left. Not only are you surrounded by art, but you can see yourself surrounded by art. Cool or what?"
Cool.
So,
but you know what? It's actually pronounced Rivoli.
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 Okay, what was I saying?
Rivoli.
The Rivoli. Well, I'm saying it the Italian way.
Oh, so you're saying it right. I see.
Everyone else is wrong.
I got it. Okay, that's acceptable.
So there was a Monday night comedy show at the mm-hmm. at the Rivoli, and the Kids in the Hall eventually took it over because they performed there so much.
Mm-hmm.
So they would, this was like a weird thing about the Kids in the Hall. They would never do the same sketch twice.
Wow.
Yeah. So this was Bruce McCullough's insistence.
But it wasn't improv.
They improvised.
Oh, it was improv.
And they would never do the same sketch twice. So that's like they're always improvising. Everything was just an improv.
Okay.
And so they wouldn't repeat their material.
Wow.
Why not? Bruce McCullough, this is something he insisted on. He'd learned it from the Loose Moose. And this is a quote from Bruce McCullough. He said, "If you ever repeated material, you were a hack."
Hmm.
This was like this kind of pure artistic improv in intent.
Well, I mean, to be fair, it's not improv anymore if you do it again.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
But guess what? The shows were incredibly inconsistent.
Which improv always is.
Exactly. And the audience wasn't really growing.
Okay.
They'd have 15, 20 people, basically, for their shows for this first several months that they did it. They actually thought they might call it quits, too, because it was just like wasn't really gaining a following.
Wow.
Then in March of 1984, they did like a best of sketches. So mm-hmm. where they like presented their most popular material. So they decided, okay, we are going to repeat our sketches. Mm-hmm. We're going to choose the ones that we know work best or mm-hmm. that people like best, and that really worked. And the Kids in the Hall suddenly like really became a hot ticket.
So do you know if it was kind of like loosely scripted or was it like scripted word for word? If you know what I mean.
I think what happens is, I mean, by the time you're watching it, you're watching Kids in the Hall on TV, like there's a script. It's written and they're following
it. It's written, okay.
But improv is like a technique for coming up with new material, right?
Yeah.
And then trying it out and then seeing what works and then refining it. So that's how improv is generally now used in comedy.
Okay.
I think if you were a purist live theater type as Bruce McCullough was, like, he's, I think, very, of the group, I think he's like one of the more intentionally, self-consciously artistic.
Okay.
That you'd want to do, no, I'm an improv guy, I only improv, we never repeat anything, that's hack, that's bullshit. Like, that Got was it. Kind of Bruce McCullough's purest intention, but yeah. It didn't work until they actually started to refine the material that they came up with while doing improv.
Interesting, okay.
Yeah. So they would do, I mean, the shows would be like part of it improv, part of it prepared sketches too. Like, that's kind of what the kids in the hall would end up doing. What kind of improv were the kids in the hall? I mean, it's not like improv was around before them, right? So you might say that they were like the second wave of improvisational comedy. So the first wave being like Second City.
Mm-hmm.
So the second wave coming from something called theater sports. This was something that they did a lot at Loose Moose. So theater sports was like part of an improv theory put forth by a guy named Keith Johnston. Now, he was a British actor who came to Calgary and was a longtime professor at the University of Calgary, and he co-founded the Loose Moose Theater using his like techniques and theories of improv. And so theater sports was a big part of that. Theater sports being competitive, where you have teams of improvisers competing against each other for points from the audience or from a judge or something like that. Mm-hmm. So there's a competitive energy to it.
And he invented that, or like coined that term?
He coined the term, and okay. Maybe developed the system in a book from 1979 called Impro, Improvisation and the Theater. So this was like his famous book, and I think it was used as like a manual to teach uh-huh. improvisation. So that's the Calgary influence, but theater sports, it goes beyond Calgary, and indeed the Toronto guys, Kevin McDonald and Dave Foley, they're doing theater sports too. And in fact, that's like how these groups interact with each other, because they compete against each other in theater sports.
Got events. It.
Yeah. So now so there's frantic competition. There's also like traditional improv, like it was really quick to, like, it was really about establishing the characters in the scene and the place of the scene and all that, all those details of a scene as quickly as possible. Whereas this kind of Johnston style, it focused more on unleashing like childlike creativity and even revealing Freudian depths.
Ooh.
So it encouraged, you know, what you might think of as like strange and surreal connections to emerge
in a
more liberated way. You can see, yeah, so that's maybe, you can kind of see that in the Kids
Absolutely,
in the Hall style.
Yeah.
Yeah. Another influence on the Kids in the Hall is obviously Monty Python.
Yeah.
Right. So, yeah, especially with the plain female characters.
Yeah.
So they were very aware when they became popular that they were, yeah, clearly like similar to Monty Python. Mm. So they were consciously trying to do something a little bit different, but the connections are there.
Yeah, definitely.
They also made a conscious choice to not do parody of news items or current events or celebrities the way that SCTV did and the way that SNL
that's right yeah they SNL never did does. That yeah
they never did that they didn't they were aware that that would date the material, which is true, because going back and watching
sure.
you know, you're like, you can watch that again, you can watch the Kids in the Hall now and really enjoy it, and it doesn't feel
of course it feels dated in some ways in the sense of technologies and fashions and stuff, but yeah, like not referring to people that are no longer front of mind, let's say.
Yeah,
like, yeah, it is. It
well,
is
or people
pretty,
that know you wouldn't even know.
Yeah, for sure. But even like not referring to like the prime minister or the president or like people that you would probably know, but it's just not really something that you think about very much. It's smart.
I think like it stands up better than watching old SNL skits or something where it's referring to like events of the day and stuff. So they didn't want to be topical. They wanted to do something else. And what they ended up doing is like their material comes from, it seems to be just about more about like everyday life, quotidian characters, fathers, mothers, we've talked about businessmen, cab drivers. It's about like their, you know, I guess you'd say an everyday world.
Yeah, it's almost domestic in a lot of ways.
A lot of it's domestic. Yeah. A lot of it is a workplace, or a lot of it is out on the street too. But it's just like the everyday world, from kind of a personal perspective that somehow is also very relatable.
Yeah, I guess like family life and work life are like their often their targets, right?
I think it ends up being more personal and relatable because it's not about celebrities or public figures in other ways or big, you know, they're not making, I mean, if they're satirizing something, I mean, they are, it's something much more intimate.
That's right.
Than what you'd normally get in like with the impression of a president or something.
And there's also, I mean, that kind of observational humor that was like really popular then where it's like minutia of human interactions, like where someone has a crumb stuck to their face and like they can't get it off and the person's like,
you mean Bruce McCullough as like a kind of a greasy businessman?
Yeah, yeah, and he has a piece mustache. Of food in his mustache.
He has a cucumber.
And he can't get it out, and it just like goes to absurd levels. But that kind of recognizable moment where you don't know if you should tell someone if they have something on their face, and then you tell them, and then they think they got it off, but it's still there, and you have to keep saying, no, it's still there. Yeah. I mean, it's like that kind of minute observation. And then, almost Seinfeldish, and it's...
Yeah.
You know?
Seinfeld is happening, you know, the kids and all runs to 95. Mm-hmm. So Seinfeld is not that long. Like, I mean, that's happening already, Seinfeld in the 90s, so...
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely grosser and goes further into, like, just absurd... Yeah. Grotesquery, but there's a bit of a similarity there.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kevin MacDonald would do a guest spot on Seinfeld in the late season.
Really?
I think he plays a guy named like Denim Guy. They call him Denim Guy because he wears all denim.
Okay.
And he's trying to go out with Elaine.
Okay.
If I remember correctly. In 1985, there was a glowing review in the Globe and Mail of the Kids in the Hall. The talent scout from Saturday Night Live happened to see that review and so decided they should have to set up an audition for the Kids in the Hall because SNL would regularly scout Toronto looking for, they'd go to Second City and see who's been performing and see if anybody's like appropriate for the cast on SNL. I don't know if they still do it like that in that same way. They're selling out their tickets. They're getting like 300 or 400 people to a show, right? Mm-hmm. People are lined up around the block to see them. So that gets out into the wider press and global.
Sounds fun.
Yeah. It sounds like probably the ideal time to have been a Kids in the Hall fan.
Yeah.
The talent scout was actually Pam Thomas, the now ex-wife of Dave Thomas, one half of the McKenzie brothers.
Okay.
Yeah, just as an aside.
Okay.
So at this audition, the producers of SNL were there, including Al Franken and head writer Jim Downey.
Nice.
So what happened is SNL decided to take two of the group.
What? That's so
pretty
evil.
Stupid, eh?
Which two?
It was Bruce McCullough and Mark McKinney. It was the Calgary guys. Huh. They wanted them as writers for Saturday Night Live in the 1985 and 86 season.
Did they do most of the writing for Kids in the Hall, or like, why them?
It seems insane, but of course the Kids in the Hall were not known really that well yet. And it's SNL, so they get to do what they want. Now, SNL was not making good decisions. This, like, that year was famously terrible. So they hired a bunch of actors instead of comedians to be on SNL. This included Joan Cusack and Robert Downey Jr. There's other people named I didn't write down who are like, oh, that's an actor I sort of half know.
Okay.
They're not really comedian. I mean, the tradition had been to get people from sketch and from stand-up, right? That had been the tradition. Mm-hmm. And so they were trying something new. They thought maybe, oh, well, like kind of, we might spice it up.
Mm-hmm. So
with better looking, more whatever, like Hollywood types.
Got it. So what happened though? Like Bruce and Mark, like they...
The season was a huge flop.
Oh, so they went.
They went and they worked on it and they barely got anything, any of their sketches in. Apparently the 30 Helens Agree sketch, Bruce wrote that for SNL.
Oh, wow.
And they never took it.
Oh, big mistake.
Well, I don't know if it would have worked on SNL. So they came back to Toronto after the failed season and the troupe came together again.
Mm-hmm.
Now, SNL producer and comedy kingmaker Lorne Michaels was not finished with the kids. He still liked them. He saw them perform all together at the Rivoli in a private audition in 1986. He decided that they should stay together. and that he was going to help them along. Mm-hmm. So he flew them to New York, provided them with stipends and office space, and then had them perform regularly at Caroline's, which is a famous stand-up comedy venue on Broadway.
Wowzers.
He was preparing them to film a pilot for a television series.
Okay.
Which he arranged. He ended up getting $400,000 from HBO to film this pilot, and then it was filmed. And it was aired as a special, but everyone understood, well, if it does well, that maybe this would lead to a series. It was aired October 18th, 1988. It was like at 12:30 in the morning.
And that would have been like NBC or something?
This was aired on HBO.
HBO.
It was on. Okay, it was aired on HBO, so a private cable audience. Mm-hmm. At 12:30 in the morning, so it's like,
what on earth?
Yeah, so it is like the most on television at the time. It must be the freest space possible.
Yeah, right.
Like it's HBO.
Yeah.
Where you can swear and there's nudity and stuff because it's a private subscription.
Yeah.
And it's late at night, right? So. This special, it already had a lot of the sketches that would become the classic famous ones, including Cabbage Head and Crush Your Head Guy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, that's the other one that kids were really into, was the Cabbage Head.
The Cabbage Head Guy. So Bruce McCullough is like playing like a, you know, an old-fashioned misogynist guy. He's like smoking a cigar and coming on to ladies.
In a very disgusting way,
but when they are repelled by him, he goes, is it because he plays, suddenly he flips to like being sad and pathetic and like, is it because of my cabbage head you don't like me?
Yeah, he just has a bunch of cabbage leaves stuck to his head.
Yeah, that's all he is.
So the way that that was interpreted for me via my teenage acquaintances was just like, I have a cabbage on my head. And people would just keep saying that.
That's really the least of it.
Yes.
But it is the most obvious.
Yes. All right.
Yeah,
anyway.
You can see kids. Yeah. It works for kids. But like as a kid, I don't think I connected to that sketch because I was like, the cabbage on his head is not enough for me.
No, me neither. But for some people, it was enough.
But what I didn't get, and which I get now when I see it, is like, oh, like the gender dynamics. Like, that's what's happening. It's like, oh, this guy's a total skis.
Yeah.
It's something you have to, I think, have grown up a little bit to maybe understand.
Yeah, I think so too. You also have to have actually watched it and not just heard it interpreted through other people.
You had never even seen it?
I don't think so.
Oh, okay. Well, CBC and HBO together, they ordered 22 episodes.
Okay.
So all of the seasons of The Kids in the Hall are really long. There's like 22 episodes for each. That is the old-fashioned way of doing TV.
So interestingly, though, it's set in Toronto. So like, how did that come about? Because that's... Well,
CBC was a co-producer, right?
Okay.
So they... And of course, the troupe is based in Toronto.
But there was no pressure to like make it American?
No, that was part of the appeal, I think. First of all, Lorne Michaels, none of this would have happened without Lorne Michaels' really powerful, influential comedy guru going to bat constantly for the kids in the hall. He didn't want them to split up. He wanted them to stay kind of weird in their Canadian way or whatever. And so I don't believe there was pressure for them to leave Toronto.
Interesting.
I did not hear about it.
And so they were on TV in the States too. I guess I thought that only Canadians knew about them, but it sounds like that's not the case.
I don't think they would have anything of the reputation they did if they weren't on American TV as well. And they were. And it was broadcast at the same time. Concurrently. So the kids, they shot the show at the Tommy Hunter Studio. It's on Mutual Street in Toronto. And this was away from the CBC's main studios. Now, the Ivan Fekan, he was the head of programming at CBC. He was a big personal supporter of the show.
Okay.
Like, he had worked with Lorne Michaels before. Mm-hmm. He had worked in American comedy a lot. Like, he'd worked on The Tonight Show and stuff and then come back to Canada. So he was, like, into comedy. And he was a really big supporter of the show. Now, Lorne Michaels was the actual producer, however. And he was the guy who was supposed to be in charge. But what was that like? So Scott Thompson said in 1988, quote, Lorne's like a really rich parent who leaves the care of the children to a nanny. And he continues, he really doesn't have much to do with raising us. He just occasionally peeks in and kisses us on the cheek and reads us a good night story. So their point is that he gave them a lot of leeway.
Yeah.
However, if the local producers, the CBC, if they had doubts or complaints about the show, Lauren would step in to protect them and to advocate for them. So Thompson says, we had an American hammer to smash them with. So that was how they kind of navigated this relatively free creative space. I believe Mark McKinney said, we had no sort of effective oversight. People from HBO didn't want to fly from LA to see what was going on in Toronto. They had families and stuff, so we were kind of left on our own. So that kind of weird dynamic gave them a lot of creative freedom. Norm Hiscock, who's a writer for the show, he said, I think nobody really knew what we were or understood the kids' sensibility, he said, of the CBC. I think people were scared to give us notes because they would look stupid. So that ended up being pretty good. Now, they did their 22-episode run. Every episode was introduced by the performance of the theme song. It was live. So the band was always there.
That's so neat,
the Shadowy Men were always there. It's like a twangy, kind of like a surf rock kind of song. So it has this kind of nostalgic, old-fashioned rock music with a twist on it, which to me it feels like the sensibility of the show in a lot of ways, because they're always, you know, on the show they're satirizing like basically old-fashioned families, often or you know, middle-class ways of life or whatever that are in the 90s are changing a lot, or you know, that like
gender roles as well. Like,
gender roles, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the song was extremely catchy, and it actually suited the sensibility of the show really well, I thought. The show, like, people liked it. They had their fans, but it had middling ratings, and actually HBO slated it for cancellation after the first season. Then the story goes, Mark McKinney won a Cable Ace Award.
What's that?
The Cable Ace. It was awards for cable shows.
Okay.
Back when cable was still new.
Why did only he win it?
He won for best actor because he is the best actor.
Oh, yeah, he is. Yeah, yeah.
Or Scott Thompson. It's hard to say.
No, Mark McKinney is really good.
McKinney does characters the best.
Yeah.
But what I find with Mark McKinney, though, is that you have less of a sense of who he is.
Totally. Yeah.
Everybody else. They are, I mean, I think Scott Thompson's a really good actor too, but his roles are all so much of him in them.
Yeah.
And I feel like Mark McKinney is such a good chameleon that he disappears into the characters
that's
he plays.
That's so true.
And they're amazing. But it's like you don't know Mark McKinney as
you don't feel like you do,
And when you see him in an interview, he is the least, I don't mean this in a mean way, he's like the least interesting. He's like a nice, soft-spoken, middle-class guy who's just, and everybody else is like kind of wacky. Wacky and more boisterous and
interesting
stuff. So he's like the best, in a way, the best performer. I guess winning an award like that was enough fodder for Lorne Michaels to go to HBO and say no, don't you cancel the show.
Great.
So again, Lorne Michaels is saving their butt
many
times, and so the show did get a second season, and the show kind of changes it. I think the second season's really good. They get a new director, and I feel like it's more suited to television. His name was John Blanchard. He'd worked on SCTV. They added a bunch of writers. See, before, the kids wrote all their own material, but they realized they needed to work faster, so they hired a group of writers, including Paul Bellini, who was an early fan of the show, and he's the guy who appears occasionally in a towel.
Okay.
He was a running joke that he would show up in the background of the sketches. Right. So, the kids in the hall, as individuals, as people, guess what?
What?
They're not really friends.
What?
Not exactly. This is according to that producer, Pam Thomas, who had sort of discovered them. She said that they didn't really hang out together, like after the show, the way that she'd seen, you know, other like actors on SCTV.
Yeah,
and SNL
that's really surprising.
They were hyper competitive with each other. Maybe this is the roots of the show in theater sports as well, which is competitive, right? They were brutal with each other in the writer's room. Like,
really?
They would tear each other's sketches apart because they were competing to get their own material on the show.
I
guess it would be ultimately democratic. Like, people would sort of, in the end, kind of vote and say, yeah, this works, this doesn't. And even if you were really attached to it, it would get cut. But Dave Foley said this. He said, you know, when you're with anyone else you work with, you have to have some sort of etiquette. And you have to care about their feelings. But with the kids in the hall, that's never an issue.
Oh, my gosh.
People just say what they think. So I feel that whatever it was, it worked for them.
Yeah.
Yeah, it worked.
Yeah, I mean, it did work for the audience.
The show got better. It won Gemini Awards, and it got nominated for Emmys and stuff. HBO gave kids a third season, but in season four, I don't know why this happened, the show moved to a different network. It moved to CBS. So I don't know if HBO didn't want to renew them or if they got a better offer from CBS. I'm not sure. And as you see, I think as you see the show evolve, they start to do like more and more pre-taped segments, like short films.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And Bruce McCullough really likes to do those. He would especially like to do those. So there's a famous one called Love and Sausages. I don't know if you've ever seen that one.
Not sure.
It's just like 8 minutes, black and white thing. It's kind of like a spoof on...
Okay.
Even it's like kind of set in a vaguely like... Soviet setting or whatever, and it involves a guy who works at a sausage factory, and it's like his like decrepit father, played by Scott Thompson. Like, it's the only laughs in this sketch is like Scott Thompson going, "Sausages, I want sausages," like, and he's really good, and you laugh at that. And it's very strange, but like, what was happening here is that Bruce McCullough, he wanted to get into directing, and so he was always kind of pushing these sketches that would let him.
Okay.
Do something more filmic.
Okay, okay.
Yeah. So what are your favorite sketches from the Kids in the Hall, would you say?
There's a few of them, I think, that, like, there's these recurring characters where Bruce McCullough is the dad and Scott Thompson is the mom and Dave Foley is their son.
Yeah.
And that family is really funny.
That is funny.
Yeah. And yeah. I think it's that family where I think maybe the first time it appeared... Maybe not, but I think it was the first time Bruce McCullough's character is, like, up in the middle of the night, like, chugging water. And then he's angry because the ham at dinner is too salty.
Yeah.
And they're fighting about... Well, he's, like, angry about the salty ham.
Yeah.
But the long-suffering wife just kind of takes everything in a stride and is like, oh, dear.
Yeah.
Ham is a salty food. She's always unruffled, and the husband is kind of losing his mind.
Yeah, I think it's a different sketch a little bit later where Dave Foley shows up as the son.
He sneaks into their bedroom to steal money.
And then pretends that he's sleepwalking.
Yeah,
and the mother totally buys it. Like Bruce McCullough as a dad is like, I don't think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great dynamic.
So that's what a classic grumpy dad... like sweet mom dynamic that we were talking about. Mm-hmm, yeah.
And it's tragic. It's a terrible marriage.
Yeah.
It's sad. Like you, as an adult anyway, like I see that, like, oh, that must be, like you see the humor obviously because it's, you know.
Familiar.
It's familiar.
It's an archetype.
It's an archetype exaggerated for comic effect, but like in that type are,
it is so
are
sad.
Real feelings.
Ugh.
Like,
yeah.
Like relationships that you can understand.
You feel so bad for the mom.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Like the dad's just insufferable.
And there's this shitty kid who's just like stealing from his parents.
But she loves him so much she can't see it. Yeah.
Now, what about the chicken lady? We brought
this
up.
I hate the chicken lady. You hate.
So the chicken lady.
I still hate the chicken lady.
Okay, but I think one of the funniest sketches that I've ever seen on the show is the chicken lady at the male strip club.
Okay, it was really funny, yes. I admit. It is funny.
So the chicken lady is an animal. Just as a concept, it's like, okay, what if a woman was also a chicken?
Or a chicken was somehow a woman.
And they end up giving this character backstory. Like,
oh, do they?
Yes.
Okay.
And I believe it's one of the early or one of the first chicken lady sketches. Dave Foley shows up as a date answering like a personals ad at the chicken lady's apartment.
Okay.
He comes in and he's like immediately frightened, scared witless by her, but she's extremely strong because she's half animal. I like these elements of this character that give her like animalic strength.
Uh-huh.
So she like basically like forces him in. And then at one point she points at the wall and goes, oh, that's my mom. And it's a picture of a chicken. And that's a laugh. And then she goes, and that's my dad. And it pans over, and it's a picture of a disgusting-looking farmer who's, like, trying to block out the camera lens. I mean, that tells the whole story. You're like, oh, wow.
That's just horrifying.
Conceived in sin and just shame, you know?
That's so horrible.
Talk about deep pathos. This is freak. Who can't find love.
Oh, my God.
You know, and she's incredibly horny. She's just incredibly horny. She ends up calling, when Dave Foley escapes, she ends up calling like a male escort service or whatever. But and it's clear that she calls all the time. And she spends all of her money on male prostitutes.
Oh, my God.
It's like really sad. Very sad. Very. But then there's just the surface level comedy of... Mark McKinney acting like a chicken and all the ways that he's made a person into a chicken, and that at that level you're laughing at it.
Yeah.
But they do go further. They give this character this kind of tragic like pathos.
Yeah, as they often do.
Incredible. I mean,
where you feel almost like in pain watching it.
It's it's hard to watch.
Yes.
And to me, like those kinds of Kids in the Hall sketches reveal how close, really, sadness is with humor.
Mm.
How those two emotions are like so closely related.
Yes.
Often you're looking at these characters and going, the reason you're laughing at them because it's comically exaggerated, but it's also because I feel like there's something psychological where you laugh not to cry.
Yeah.
You know, when you see something that is sad and tragic, you can twist it, present it and twist it in a certain way that the response ends up being laughter.
Yeah, and I mean, the sort of domestic / you know, workplace / everyday scenes that they start out with,
yeah,
are so relatable in this way where, like, either you or your parents or your grandparents or someone close to you, yeah, has kind of been in that situation, or you yourself could easily end up in that situation.
Yeah.
It's like a cultural phenomenon that occurs all the time, and it is so, yeah, tragic is really the only word for it. Like women stuck in marriages with, like, yeah, grumpy, horrible men and are like 100% financially dependent on them and can't,
yeah,
like have no, yeah, other option. And alcoholism, which comes up a lot. And that kind of, yeah, like, I mean, they make fun of businessmen a lot.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's kind of like, those characters are tragic too.
Yeah.
They're
stuck in these rote, mechanical, boring lives.
And their jobs are portrayed as like pure, meaningless bureaucracy, basically. Mm-hmm. And then also, like Scott Thompson sometimes portrays these like closeted or bullied gay characters.
Yeah.
And that's also very, I mean, that's very real.
Yeah.
And it's so close to like, how could this be funny? But somehow they push it so far.
Yeah.
That it's funny. But yeah, you are like on the edge of wanting to cry for sure. Or just feeling like not wanting to watch it anymore because it's so painfully sad.
John Stanley called it, called them like the foremost practitioners of Gen X gallows humor.
Mm-hmm.
And that might, mm-hmm, be true. That might be a thing that Gen X did especially,
mm-hmm,
with like the dark humor, the gallows, yeah, humor.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's exactly what it is. Yeah,
yeah.
Sums it up.
There's one, tons of businessmen, right? And what they do with businessmen is so funny, like you said. Like there's that one where Kevin McDonald is a businessman that Bruce McCullough, who's playing like a kid, maybe 10 or 12 years old, brings home as if he's a lost puppy. And that's, yeah, the premise. And so this businessman acts just like
a pet,
like a lot, but he doesn't know how to do anything,
mm-hmm,
except all of these ticks and rote behavior that he learned as a businessman. So he's like trying to hail a cab, but standing in the kitchen or whatever.
And like pressing buttons on, yeah, a calculator.
Yeah. Yeah. Just
yeah.
To no end. Right. And then they follow that premise all the way through to like having to let the businessman go back to his natural milieu on Bay Street.
Yeah.
Where he like releases him in the wilds to meet up with other businessmen.
And they all get in a taxi.
And all what they do is they all shake hands and they, yeah, all like trade business cards. Yeah. And it's like, and it's just the performance of these behaviors. It's not like,
well, they're not even speaking, right?
No,
they're
don't
going,
speak.
They're going like,
that's right. That's right. There's another one where there's Courier de Bois, like these French, you know, fur traders,
yeah,
paddling around in a canoe in an office space. And what they're doing is trapping the office workers. So they show these gross scenes of like someone with their like suited leg, like their dress shoe, caught in a like a bear,
oh,
trap.
My God.
And what they're doing is they're skinning them for their suits. And so then the final scene is them arriving at a suit shop.
Yeah.
And Scott Thompson is like a hilariously smarmy like salesman. He's,
yeah,
like, "What you got for me today, boys?" And they show like this collection of Armani suits and stuff that they just take in from them. So, you know, it is really good. It's just like, let's say the modern business person, office workers, they're just hapless, you know?
Mm.
They're,
and there's also the secretaries, right? Like there's the businessmen,
the Cathys,
and then there's the secretaries.
The famous secretaries of the,
yeah,
Cathy, the two,
yeah,
Cathys, Bruce McCullough,
yeah,
and Scott Thompson. And yeah, again, you feel, you know, it's just like, oh, this is such a terrible life working in an
office,
right?
Their jobs are so boring, so tedious.
So there is, again, this kind of, I think, a Gen X critique, you know, the alt culture critique of the mainstream that would become basically mainstream culture in the 90s, which is like, oh, boring 9-to-5 job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you need to escape that by being more authentic, more spontaneous, more yourself.
Like, be an improv actor. But, you know, it's funny thinking about how that, like, ethos, like, even if, like, I say I hated Kids in the Hall or I didn't get it or whatever, like,
yeah.
I'm, like, on the edge, you know, of millennial and Generation X, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, like, for sure, I feel like I relate to that Gen X thing. I mean, Kids in the Hall are, like, 10, 15 years older
than me.
They're
60.
Yeah, so they're 15 years older than me. But, like, they're still that same kind of growing up with boomer parents.
Yeah.
And growing up with, like, a real sort of, like, it's not just that the depiction of the office workers is scathing. I feel like it's more, it's not so much scathing as, like, again, what we were saying, tragic, kind of like the worst thing that could ever happen to you is that you'd end up being a businessman or, like, a secretary working in an office.
Yeah.
Where, like, you're not really doing anything. You're just kind of, like, you know, going around like a robot in your, like, your uniform, you know?
Yeah, what's the opposite of that? Being, like, a fun, free improv actor who just flies by the seat of their pants and invents and creates the world as they go, right? In 1996, they made a movie called Brain Candy.
Oh, yeah.
So Paramount gave them $7 million to do it. Lorne Michaels was the producer.
Uh-huh.
This is not remembered fondly by the kids in the hall, this whole experience. It was a very tumultuous time in everyone's life. Dave Foley was getting divorced. So was Kevin MacDonald. Scott Thompson's brother had committed suicide. And the group was kind of falling apart just because their dynamic with each other was pretty bad.
So it must have been hard to make a movie together.
Yeah, but they insisted on doing it. Now, Dave Foley actually didn't want to make the movie. He had chose not to do it.
Okay.
he didn't like the script, and he had another job on news radio. Yeah, so News Radio was a really big show. It ended up, like, running for five or six
TV
seasons.
But so it was, like, an American TV show. It was, like, a sitcom with...
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's pretty well known. It was in syndication for a long time. You know, Dave Foley played the station manager of a radio station, and he's, like, the straight man to kooky characters, including Phil Hartman, who's, like, the hilariously egotistical and stupid on-air personality or whatever, and I think, like, Andy Dick's there, and Joe Rogan is on the show too. It just is, as a formula, it worked really well. It was a good show.
And I don't think I ever really saw it, but I remember it existing.
You never really watched News Radio?
No.
I watched it regularly in syndication.
Okay.
Yeah. Dave Foley had that going on, and he didn't really want to work on the movie, but he was contractually obligated to.
Okay.
And they sued him to enforce the contract.
Oh, my goodness.
So as you see in the Amazon documentary that was recently put out, there's all this...
I haven't seen it, but...
They make a big point. They do dwell on this a little bit, showing how alienated he was from the rest of the troupe and how actually they weren't talking to each other.
Because he was forced to be in this movie he didn't want to be in.
Yeah, so they were not friends anymore.
Wow.
At that point in the filming of this movie. So you can imagine it being extremely stressful, right?
No kidding. All of that sounds like a nightmare.
Foley said, there was a certain amount of arrogance on my part. I thought I didn't need it anymore. I stopped valuing what the kids in the hall were to me. So
he thought he'd moved on to bigger and better things.
That's right. That's right. And so Brain Candy, just the story is, it's a spoof of the pharmaceutical industry. Brain Candy referring to antidepressant drugs, right? So Kevin MacDonald plays a scientist who invents an antidepressant, Gleeman-X, and it gets marketed abusively by the corporation he works for. Mark McKinney plays the evil CEO, basically doing an impression of Lorne Michaels.
Okay. And they're like, the pharmaceutical company is like about to go under, kind of thing. Like, they're doing terribly and they're desperate for a new drug.
Yes.
So when they find out there's an antidepressant that works, they start not only prescribe, like, allowing it to be prescribed, but then selling it over the counter.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, with not enough research.
Yes, and then...
That's the premise.
Yeah, that's the premise. And so what ends up happening, kind of a crisis...
The whole world is taking it because it works so well.
Yes, everybody's taking it. It functions by making people remember their happiest memory. So there's great cutaway scenes where you're seeing people's happiest memories, and it's so funny, revealing
but
of the character.
But sad too.
Yeah, like, oh, this again.
This Scott is the best thing that ever happened. It's so sad.
Scott Thompson again playing this kind of long-suffering mother whose happiest memory is when her like shitty son, played by Dave Foley, shows up at Christmas with his like shitty family and comes in, takes their presents and walks out the door.
Before dinner.
And this is the 32nd happiest memory of her life that she is like reliving constantly. And it's so like, oh my gosh.
So sad. But then meanwhile, Scott Thompson also plays a closeted gay man, and his best memory is when like his when he was in the military and he was forced to do push-ups with like his sergeant?
Yes.
Lying on top of his back?
That's right. Yeah, it's good. It's good. This movie, quite frankly, is very good. And it didn't, like, surprise, it didn't do well. Like, mm-hmm. It's considered a failure. Even the kids in the hall talk about it as a failure. It was like the time that their career crested. It was like they saw, oh, their popularity start to wane after this. Like, oh, we failed. They figured we failed at something.
It's hard to understand, like, why it was considered a failure when watching it now, it feels like such a natural extension of the TV show. Like, if this TV show were to be a movie, this is the movie it would be.
And they managed to like get in all of their spontaneous, fun, surprising comic bits, mm-hmm. so classically Kids in the Hall, but they managed to attach that to a very convincing kind of through line narrative.
Yeah,
there's like an arc for this scientist who is kind of corrupted. He sells out, right? This is much like an artist. Like, it's so clearly like a parallel to an artist's life who creates something good, this drug, and he sells it, ends up being abused. He sells out.
Mass marketed,
and he's like seduced by the fame and the fortune.
Yeah.
But then he has a turn where he realizes it was a mistake. Like, the through line is like good.
I mean, but it also includes that Kids in the Hall absurdist kind of, there'll be scenes that kind of don't have anything to do with anything.
Yeah.
That are just like sort of off in left field and that are bizarre. Like, at one point, the therapist who's working with the closeted man also has this other patient who just like speaks in German, and the therapist doesn't know German.
Yeah.
And he's like this German nihilist kind of character.
Yeah, that's right.
And so there will be these kind of tangents, like brief tangents into tangents into absurdity.
Yeah.
And that retains like the twisty-turny absurd feeling of the sketches on the show without actually making you sit through a whole movie without a through line, because it has a very clear through line.
That's right. That's right. I think the movie works really well, but it didn't recuperate its costs at the box office. It only made $2 million, I guess, and it's
also just interesting, like watching that movie now and seeing how the whole thing about antidepressants like really speaks to a sort of a conversation, almost a panic of the time.
Yeah.
Antidepressants were becoming very popular for the first time, and they were all over the news, and a lot of people were starting to take them. And at the same time, a lot of people were very adamantly against them and felt that, you know, like, if all your negative emotions are taken away, then you're just going to be unable to be critical and unable to be creative, right?
Yeah. Kevin McDonald says as much. He says, you need your dark side as much as you need your good. Being happy all the time is as bad as being depressed all the time. Killing depression kills creativity. That may be fucked up, but we believe it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that would be true for the Kids in the Hall, whose creativity, humor, is based so much on finding the dark side.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. I mean, unfortunately, there is no real antidepressant that completely takes away all your negative emotions and thoughts and turns you into a happy zombie, fortunately or unfortunately.
Right.
But in the movie, it's just this kind of exaggerated state that people go into where, they're in the same emotional state they were in their happiest memory permanently.
Well, there's a side effect that puts people into a coma.
Right.
This is a reveal. It's the crisis point of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when Kevin McDonald turns. He's like, oh no, we have to like tell everybody about this side effect. And because, yes, people are stuck living their happiest moment on repeat. So it's kind of like a critique of our own culture now more than anything, which is a very nostalgic culture, like reliving the past over and over again. Kids in the Hall have a moment again now, because they yeah. have a new season out, and obviously they're very nostalgic.
Everything's nostalgic. Everything's we're nostalgic obsessed now. With the past, and even yeah.
That's not a good thing.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
like as much as it's helpful to like look at the past, maybe understand it, mm-hmm. critique it too. Like like not having a vision of the future is very scary, and I feel like we are kind of in a moment where we don't have very much.
Well, and also just
of a vision of a future.
Dismissing the present as having any value is really bad as well. Because I mean, there's this kind of nostalgia. It does involve remembering the past as having been ideal, or at least a lot better than the present, mm-hmm. In a way that is necessarily distorting the past. Right? Mm-hmm. I mean. Like those happy memories that we saw those people having, like we were saying, they weren't even necessarily that great. Mm. But in their memory, they were, you know, this better, wonderful time that'll never be recaptured.
Yeah.
And it's almost like the way that, like, in the 80s, people, or, you know, Reagan remembered the 50s or whatever, in the way yeah. that, like, it's almost like that Make America Great Again rhetoric. Like, the past was beautiful and better. There was this moment that was perfect.
Yeah.
And the best thing we can do is try to recapture that and, like, live in that. When that, like, by definition, never existed, right, in that form. So,
yeah.
like, nostalgia is not only dangerous because you're not paying attention to or valuing the present or anticipating or planning for the future, but you're actually remembering the past inaccurately.
So what happens after Kids in the Hall? Everyone goes their own way for a few years anyway, doing their own thing. I already mentioned Dave Foley with his television show, News Radio. He was getting divorced. Now, there's actually, it was in the press quite a bit, Dave Foley's problems with his ex-wife.
Oh.
So he had married in 1991, Tabitha Selde.
The columnist.
The columnist.
Okay.
Yeah. And they divorced in 97. They had two kids together. A child support agreement obligated Foley to pay over $10,000 a month in child support. That was based on his highest ever salary when he was working on network television with News Radio. So after that, though, his salary went down, but he still had to pay the same amount of child support. At one point, he said that was four times what he was making total. So he could not pay.
He was making a quarter of $10,000 a month.
No. Well, yeah, I guess what he was saying for a certain part. I mean, after the show's over.
Wow. Okay.
I mean, a quarter of $10,000 a month. I don't know. Maybe he was exaggerating.
Maybe.
Who knows? He would have an incentive to like lie, I guess. Okay. But who
Maybe
knows?
Maybe being a celebrity isn't all it's cracked up to be.
I think it depends if you're working or if you're not. And that's the big thing.
Right.
He wasn't really working much anymore. So he owed $500,000 in back payments. He thought if he returned to Canada, he'd be put in jail. Selde and Foley, they settled their child support issues in 2013. So now Foley is not going to go to jail.
Excellent. Well, that's a bonus for all involved.
Yeah. Scott Thompson, he had a role in the Larry Sanders Show. He started to feel kind of embittered by the fact that he was always cast as a gay man. He said, quote, "For 10 years, it was hire Scott Thompson so we can show that we're on the right page socially, that we're liberal. Mm. I felt that people were using me." So Scott Thompson, he also appeared at the Griffin Poetry Awards in 2001. He joked about poets urinating on their partners, and he pulled out a dildo and wagged it around.
All right.
And Margaret Atwood
poets love that.
And I guess it didn't go over well in the room.
Like, okay.
Margaret Atwood and Michael Ondaatje and stuff were there. So
you're implying that they're not into giant dildos wagging around? Okay.
Probably not
at their poetry award dinner.
Probably not.
Yeah.
Kevin MacDonald had a lot of bit roles over the years. He's a good character actor. I mentioned him on Seinfeld already. He jokes about being the least popular of the kids in the hall.
Really?
Yeah. He said that, this is like a little thing. He said, okay, whenever we got fan mail, Dave would get fan mail saying, "Dave, you're really cute and I'd like to marry you." I got fan mail that said, "Kevin, you seem pretty nice. Can you tell Dave he's cute and that I'd like to marry him?"
That's funny that Dave was like considered the cute one.
Yeah.
He's like the bland. He's like the regular looking one, really.
He was more often than not the straight man.
Yeah, he's like the normie one.
Yeah. McCullough got into directing. He directed Dog Park, a 1998 movie with Luke Wilson, Superstar. That was the The Mary Catherine Gallagher movie, that character from SNL played by Molly Shannon, that was from 1999. He directed Stealing Harvard, featuring Tom Green and Jason Lee, from 2002. More recently, he's directed Schitt's Creek, like episodes of the show, as well as Trailer Park Boys. Mark McKinney, he was a performer on SNL from 95 to 97. So, like, he's a very good actor, and he could do all kinds of impressions.
I don't remember him being on SNL, but maybe I just wasn't watching.
I wasn't watching much from 95 to 97. He did Al Gore, Ellen DeGeneres, Wolf Blitzer. He even reprised some characters from Kids in the Hall, including the Chicken Lady. He, like, I think one of his biggest things post-Kids was he co-created and co-starred in a CTV kind of a prestige comedy. It was kind of comedy drama called Slings and Arrows. It's like about the theater.
Right.
Behind the scenes of the theater.
I remember that.
And it's like a sophisticated and quite a good comedy. It starred Paul Gross.
Right.
It ran Canadian for 3 years. Very Canadian. Icon. Very Canadian. Very Canadian. Okay. So now we've entered the time where we start to remember the Kids in the Hall instead of it being ongoing. So, and that happens almost immediately. The Kids in the Hall reruns are played consistently, constantly on Comedy Central. And
the Canadian Comedy...
Comedy Network is the one in Canada.
Okay.
Yeah, so those are the two cable networks. It's mostly comedy stuff. And they're really, really popular. It's the second most watched show on the network after SNL. What the actors notice is that they're starting to get stopped in the street more now than ever. Even more than when the show was in production.
So it's more popular than
before. A whole second wave of fans are created, basically. So this helps cement their legacy. And it also makes them realize, oh, there's like an audience out there for us still. So they go on tour. They reunite and they go on a big tour in 2000.
Even though like they don't like each other and they tried to sue.
They got over it.
Oh, okay. Okay.
As you said, I mean, they were, earlier we said how they were, you know, very, they were like professional, you know, like their friendships were not that personal in a lot, it seemed, in a lot of ways. That
so they're colleagues.
They had good, they tried to have a good working relationship. So I'm just kind of, I'm sure they're friends or whatever, but all the other post Kids in the Hall careers had kind of slowed down, you know, more or less. And so they go on a tour, a 25-date North American tour. It's like a triumphant tour. There's actually a documentary made behind the scenes during that tour. And they do it again and again and again, 2002, 2007. And they've never really, I mean, they have pretty regularly, they'll go on a tour, do a live performance. Even recently, kind of in promotion for the latest season of Kids in the Hall, they performed at the Rivoli together or something. So, trying to just talk about nostalgia.
Yeah.
Going back to where it all began.
Nostalgia's not all bad.
Not at all. No, not at all. I don't know what we'd have if we didn't have nostalgia for this podcast.
That's right.
Like, what would we be talking about? The kids started to, they wanted to work on a new television project. They didn't want to do sketch comedy again, and they didn't want to do a film again. So they did a mini series instead. It's called Death Comes to Town, and it came out on CBC in 2010.
Okay.
And it's set in a small town. It was filmed in North Bay.
Sounds vaguely familiar.
Yeah, I saw it at the time, and I remember thinking, meh.
Yeah.
And I rewatched some of it recently, and I thought, meh. Like, I think my assessment was fair. And the critics more or less had...
That's too bad.
There are mixed reviews. It's not bad. There's stuff in it that wouldn't pass muster now. Like, just kind of like... There's a character who's like... severely obese, and that's the joke, and you're like, I don't know if you can do that. Like Bruce McCullough's playing someone who's like stuck on their couch.
Okay.
And Scott Thompson tries to do this indigenous thing. It does not work.
That sounds
bad.
The
time it doesn't work. I mean, the joke is that the guy is not really indigenous.
Oh.
But he's throughout he's like doing indigenous stereotype stuff. So it's like, it was like, this isn't
well,
really
making working. Fun of pretending to be indigenous.
Is a different, that's how you would defend it.
Yeah.
Yes.
But if you wanted to.
I just don't think it, I just don't think it really works. I think like, whereas Brain Candy, the movie, did a really good job at like maintaining a consistent narrative through line, as well as providing all that spontaneous humor from the sketch comedy that we love from the Kids in the Hall. This somehow loses some of that spark. I think there's a little bit too much narrative. They kind of do something it's like a murder mystery kind of. Like Mark McKinney plays the devil and he comes to town and he's like going, who's going to die next? That's kind of like, and then, and he's also like, as the devil, he's like inspiring, he's like possessing somebody to go murder.
Oh, okay.
And so we don't know who that murderer is. Oh. So there's a bit of a murder mystery element. So there's a lot of narrative in it. And I feel like that's obviously not the Kids in the Hall's strongest point. What you really want is the goofs and the gags.
Yeah.
And I feel like they're a little diminished
in
this one, but it's not bad. I think, okay, most recently, though, they, you know, they put out the sixth season of the original Kids in the Hall. That's how they marketed it.
Yeah.
It even had the same opening, the same theme music, and they even did the same thing with, like, the black and white interstitials and stuff. So they really wanted to make it look like the original series. They made it clear this was the sixth, a much belated sixth season of the original series. Amazon has purchased all of their stuff, so it's on Amazon Prime now. So all the early seasons... in Canada, you can't see Brain Candy on Amazon, but in the States you can.
Right.
So Amazon owns their back catalog now or is renting it or whatever. I think this new season, this latest season, it was good. I remember being surprised. Like, oh, this is actually good. This is worth watching. This is fun. There's like a lot of that original Kids in the Hall energy without it being purely fan service. It's like they do new characters. Like,
yes.
They're now old men. I mean, they're older men. They're six in their 60s for the most part. And they, so they're doing the Kids in the Hall stuff, which might involve weird characters and gross out stuff, but they're doing it now as old men. And it's kind of nice to see it because it's like, oh, this works.
Yeah, it does work. It
works.
Totally works.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you think about it?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because I watched that with you, the sixth season, before going back. So I kind of didn't know much about Kids in the Hall.
Yeah.
So I watched that almost cold, like thinking I wouldn't like it.
Yeah, because you had not good memories.
Yeah. And then I was like, oh, this is actually really funny.
Yeah.
And then going back and kind of sophisticated and all the things we said about Kids in the Hall.
Yeah.
And so even without the nostalgia,
because
for me, there, I didn't have any nostalgia about it. And so even without the nostalgia, it was good. It was really funny. And then going back and watching the original show, I was like, oh, I totally misunderstood. This is actually really good.
Yeah.
And the sixth season is like a very seamless continuation of the first five, even though it's 20 years later. And... it's seamless, but it's also updated to fit the times in subtle ways.
Right. Can you think of a sketch that you liked from the latest season? Well, they bring back, they don't do all of the fan favorites. I don't, was there a Cabbage Head?
There was no Cabbage Head that I recall, but there
there's no Chicken Lady.
There's no Chicken
Lady. But there was Head Crusher.
Head Crusher, but he was crushing the CN Tower, and they had to. He was holding it hostage. and they had to go in and like negotiate with him and stop him from crushing the CN Tower, which is actually really funny.
It really worked.
Yeah, it was like, a great update of that gag.
Yeah, that was a great update of that gag. And the new gag.
Oh, and you know what else I liked was the sketch where. It was the couple with the son again. It was Bruce McCullough as the grumpy dad with Scott Thompson as the mom, the long-suffering mom, and Dave Foley as the son. Everybody's, obviously 20 years older. But the mom always had that, like, gray wig, so she still like, looks the same.
That's true.
But the parents kind of look the same. But anyway.
Yeah. what happens in that?
The dad's trying to make like an anniversary surprise on the lawn for the mom, and they both have heart attacks.
Oh, that's right.
And have to go to the hospital.
Right, yeah, they're playing. That's right. Yeah.
But like, it's funny because watching that one, he didn't seem that grumpy, and their relationship didn't seem that bad.
Yeah.
So then going back and seeing where that originated, it was a lot darker.
It was.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a lot darker. I don't think. Bruce McCullough is, like, I think a pretty happy family man.
Yeah.
You know? So I don't think...
Like, maybe, in real life?
Yeah. He wrote an autobiography in 2014, and a lot of it's about being a dad.
I think.
How different he's trying to be than his own dad.
But you know what's funny about it? And I don't know if this is intentional, but a lot of, like, grumpy dads who are grumpy dads in their, like, 40s or even younger, like, by the time they're in their 60s, they're not really that grumpy anymore.
You never know. Life can take you in different directions.
By the time you kind of retire, like, life's not so stressful anymore.
I mean, hopefully.
Hopefully.
Or it could be more stressful.
It could be. But I think for a lot of people, like, you know how a lot of people will end up being like pretty chill as grandparents, and they were like kind of out of control as parents.
Yeah, yeah.
Like they're just like more mature, they're more relaxed, they're more economically secure.
Yeah.
Like a lot of stressors are gone. People tend to be at their happiest statistically in their 60s.
That's right. I think that's if you're, yeah. I mean, we're talking about boomers though too, right? So.
Sure.
Maybe generationally specific experience
yes,
in some ways.
But it's still a thing.
Definitely, definitely. Yeah. So I think, yeah, there's a much chiller.
So the fact that grouchy dad has turned into a kind of
chiller,
a guy who wants to make an anniversary like surprise for his wife, even though he doesn't do it very well.
Doesn't do it very well.
And he's making his like middle-aged son videotape it.
That's right.
Or he recorded on his phone.
On his
or
phone,
whatever.
That's right. Trying to do TikTok or something.
Yeah,
that was good. That was a really nice update. Yeah.
Oh, you know who else came back? Sorry, is the guy from Brain, the boss from Brain Candy, who was the big boss of the pharmaceutical company. He's back, but now he's the big boss of the television company.
Yeah.
And it's like this meta thing where they're the ones making the new Kids in the Hall.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's
and Dave Foley, who was like the long-suffering assistant in the movie, is also that assistant again. So that's kind of funny.
Yeah. They use their like older, you know, the bodies of older men they have now. They use that for comic effect.
Yes.
Which is exactly what Kids in the Hall would do.
Yes.
You know, so you see...
They're like, naked a lot.
I think we see penises, don't we? They're naked quite a bit.
They're naked quite a bit.
So I think the first episode, the first sketch, something.
Yeah,
they
like unearth them. They like literally dig them up and they're lying in the ground naked.
They're naked in the
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And, that was really neat how they did that, because at the end, the series ended with them being buried.
They buried again, yeah.
No, but the original series,
it
ended with them being buried.
Oh, did it?
Yeah. Yeah, that's something I realized going back. I'm like, oh, that's so great that they started from that point.
That is really funny. They dig them back up.
Dig them back up, yeah.
Reanimate them.
Yeah. So this is a good review for season 6 of Kids in the Hall.
Yes.
Any final remarks about Kids in the Hall, Naomi, you want to leave the world with?
Well, I mean, I've said it, I guess, all through this, but it's really been redeemed for me because it was kind of like, the nostalgia thing really doesn't apply for me because I didn't really know it. And what I did know of it, I didn't like.
Yeah.
And I didn't understand what it was.
Yeah.
Like, I really misunderstood it.
Yeah.
So this was a completely new, like, it was like a...
Discovering something.
And it was realizing, too, that I was wrong. Like, this is not what I thought it was. It's not this stupid, like Beavis and Butthead style thing, which is what I thought.
Right. There's fans of Beavis and Butthead right now going,
like, and I probably don't understand Beavis and Butthead either, because I, like, it's probably the same thing.
I never liked it. Maybe watching it again, I'd understand Beavis.
But also, you know, like, Ren and Stimpy was like that, too. It's just
that was
pure
just
gross.
That was too scary for me, man.
Yeah. Like, I remember pretending to like Beavis and Butthead.
Just to fit in.
Just because I thought it was edgy.
Right.
But it was gross and disturbing, right? And that's what I thought. My point is that Kids in the Hall is much more sophisticated and much funnier than I thought.
Yeah.
Yay.
Kids Agreed. In the Hall. Yeah. Long live Kids in the Hall.
Yeah.
I hope we get another season.
All right.
Well, I guess we can end there. Thanks.
Well, Aaron, thank you for inviting me back.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you for making the trek downstairs. And thanks, everybody, for watching and listening. And we'll see you next time.